second in our short series called Making Sense of Life. If I can have the PowerPoint up, Adrian, that'd be great. And it's based on Tim Keller's recent book, Making Sense of God. And we're going to look at these four central issues in our life. Last week we looked at meaning, this week happiness, next week freedom, and lastly identity. And we're asking, does faith in Jesus Christ make sense of life and our experience of this world in a way that nothing else quite does? And I want to start with a quote from the French philosopher Pascal, who said this: all people seek happiness without exception. Whatever means they employ, they all tend to this end. Some go to war and some avoid it, but it's the same desire in both. This is the motive of every action of every person, even those who hang themselves. And he put it even more succinctly when he said this: man wishes to be happy and cannot wish not to be happy. He's not making any judgment about it. He's just saying this is a fact, this is a law of the human heart. We're wired up to seek happiness. It's not wrong or sinful to want to be happy, it's the way we are. But of course we know that happiness is difficult to find. This book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is by Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize for inventing behavioral economics. And it's full of fascinating things, including some stuff on happiness. For instance, somebody studied people who moved from Minnesota in the north of the US to California. And when people do that, people in Minnesota, which is freezing cold and they complain about the weather all the time, and when they move to California, they're happier initially. But after a few years, their happiness levels are identical to what they were before they moved. And the reason is what they call habituation. In other words, you get used to your circumstances, whatever they are. Another finding, which is kind of unbelievable at first, is that people who are paraplegic, who have no use of their limbs, are actually don't report happiness levels any lower than people who've got all the use of their limbs. I mean, that's amazing, isn't it? And yet the truth is you get used to even being paraplegic. And we know, because there are many findings that demonstrate this, that people in the UK are no happier now than we were in the 1950s, even though we're about three times as well off in real terms. We're always being told it's the economy, stupid, buy more, do more, get more, but somehow it doesn't seem to work. Beyond a certain fairly low level of income, your wealth or your income makes no difference to how happy you are. You need enough to provide for food, shelter, and healthcare, but beyond that, income makes no difference. If somebody could come and unplug that creaking speaker, that would really help me. Tim, can you do that? It's making quite a noise in my ear here. Can you hear it or not? Douglas, can you just unplug it and then it'll stop doing that? So, beyond a certain low level, income makes no difference to happiness. Someone said, if you think money doesn't make you happy, you should go and talk to somebody who lives under a bridge. If you think money does make you happy, you should go and talk to Roman Abramovich or some other very rich person. He's just got rid of his third wife. He's ordered an even bigger yacht. He's got rid of his sixth Chelsea manager or whatever it is, or he's about to. And yet, is he happy? How much money does it take to make someone happy? Slightly more than they have at the moment. What was that, a comment about the Chelsea manager? Okay. We don't normally have audience participation, but occasionally. But it's what they call the bigger yacht syndrome, or otherwise known as the hedonic treadmill. Essentially, the more you have, the more you want. And it doesn't change your happiness level. And if you try to seek pleasure, it leads to a kind of addiction to more experience, more pleasure to satisfy your pleasure fix, and you're never content. Popular culture is telling us that pleasure and happiness are the same thing. But they're not, are they? Happiness is much harder to find than just experience. And shortcuts to happiness through buying stuff and experiences don't seem to work. In fact, they're counterproductive. A materialist, acquisitive life seems to lead to higher levels of depression and anxiety, and prescriptions of antidepressants have gone up three times in the last 10 years. The philosopher John Gray said the epidemic of drug use in Western society is a tacit admission of a forbidden truth, that for most people happiness is unattainable. Drug use is a tacit admission of a forbidden truth, that happiness is unattainable. And yet, remember Pascal, we want to be happy and we cannot wish not to be. So it's a paradox, isn't it? We long for happiness, but we can't find it. And of course, that's not new. Last week we looked at Ecclesiastes, which is a very intriguing and ancient book of the Old Testament, which relentlessly probes life under the sun. Life in this world, what is it to be human? Why is it so hard to find meaning and happiness under the sun, and yet we all long for it? I have seen all the things that are done under the sun, he writes, and all of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And do read that book, because you'll find it feels incredibly contemporary. It could be 21st century angst. There really is nothing new under the sun, a phrase that comes from that book. Well, Rachel Adams is going to read chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. And what we'll see here is that the writer is not just battling the fear of meaninglessness, which is what we looked at last week in chapter 1. But he's also battling the disappointment of success. He's a great man, possibly a king. He's immensely privileged. He has everything and does everything, and yet somehow nothing seems to bring him contentment. So Rachel's going to read chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. Thanks, Rachel.
This reading can be found on page 668. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers, and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done, and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Here ends the second reading.
Thank you. Someone called Cynthia Heimel wrote for a trendy magazine and saw a lot of her friends go from anonymity to stardom, only to find to their horror that they were no more fulfilled and happy than before. And she said it made them howling and insufferable. And we know countless celebrity stories that say the same thing, don't we? She summarized it like this: if God really wants to play a rotten practical joke on us, he grants us our deepest wish and then giggles merrily as we realize we want to kill ourselves. So how do we respond to this longing for happiness that seems so difficult to fulfill? One answer, which was offered by both Chinese and Buddhist philosophers in the East and Greek Stoics in the West, was that you should detach yourself from the world and restrain this desire for happiness. The things of this world, wealth, power, achievement, family, can bring only momentary satisfaction, which soon fades away. So instead of trying to change the world, you should change your attitude to the world. Buddha taught that when pleasure and pain come, the wise feel above pleasure and pain. I've quoted before the Stoics saying, when you kiss your child goodnight, you should whisper to yourself, this too will die. Don't get too attached to anything in this world. Well, that's one answer. But it feels wrong, doesn't it? You know, that desire for happiness in us is so strong, and our love for others is so deep that it feels deeply unnatural to say, detach yourself from the world. And it also undermines any motivation for trying to change the world. You know, rather than make the world better, we just resign ourselves to the way it is. And I think that passivity that you do find in Eastern cultures has actually done great harm. But also, there are things that have a positive effect on happiness. A few months ago, we ran the happiness course, and we looked at those sort of issues over 4 weeks. And the people who did it were roughly half churchgoers and half non-churchgoers, and I think everyone found it really helpful. And I'm going to sort of scoot through this quite briefly, but it's worth deeper reflection. Three things that make a real difference to happiness, and the first is good, stable relationships, family and friends. That's strongly linked to higher levels of happiness. Marriage is consistently shown to be the single most important factor in life satisfaction. And that holds true across cultures, ages, and income brackets. And of course, sadly, that means that divorce and separation and being widowed is harder on happiness than pretty much anything else. Someone wrote this, strong social relationships strengthen the immune system, extend life more than stopping smoking, speed recovery from surgery, and reduce anxiety and depression. So relationships matter more than money. And that's not a surprise, but do our life choices reflect that? It's easy to find ourselves serving mammon, as Jesus described it. Secondly, to find happiness, you need to look outward, not inward. I often quote something that Kierkegaard said, which is that the door to happiness opens outward. The door to happiness opens outward. It's as you give yourself away and seek the good of others that you yourself are blessed. If you seek happiness for yourself, you'll find you become depressed and anxious. But we need to listen to Jesus' words. It's better to give than to receive. That's actually true. Serving others blesses you. And so there's a strong link between community engagement and altruism and life satisfaction. But we also need to hear Nietzsche's criticism of that, because Nietzsche was very penetrating on what we're really like, and he argued that often people help the needy out of a selfish desire to feel good about themselves, to feel better than others, to feel superior to your previous unenlightened self, and to feel better than times where people were not so committed to equality. So he said people often do good for selfish reasons, and maybe we should just admit that our motives are not always as pure as we like to pretend. So relationships, altruism, and then thirdly, spirituality. Richard Layard, who was a former happiness czar, said one of the most robust findings of happiness research is that people who believe in God are happier. And interestingly, there are two different independent effects here. One is faith in something beyond this world, and the other is attendance at religious services. And those things both independently affect happiness positively. So even if you don't believe it, you should come to church because you'll feel happier. Partly, of course, because it brings you into a community and it helps you to think about others rather than yourself. And linked to faith and spirituality, I think, is thankfulness. In other words, recognizing the good things that we have. An atheist said, the hardest thing about being an atheist is I have no one to be thankful to. One of the things I found helpful on the happiness course was someone saying, it is impossible to be grateful and ungrateful at the same time. In other words, if you find something to be thankful for, it'll stop you always thinking, why haven't I got what they've got? Or I always need more. And just being happy with what you have. I was struck recently by Paul McCartney wanting to change the songwriting credits on some of his songs from Lennon and McCartney to McCartney and Lennon. You know, for goodness sake, you're one of the most successful, talented people in the history of the world, and you're bothered about whose name comes first? It's mad, isn't it? And he seems like a nice bloke, but, you know, what is he thinking of? Happiness comes from recognizing the good things that you already have and being thankful for them. So relationships, altruism, and spirituality are genuine contributors to happiness. And I don't think the Stoics and Buddhists are right to say repress that desire for happiness within you. We can't not want to be happy. And it's what makes you human and not an animal, not a beast, that we long for joy and meaning and fulfillment. But to repeat the point, where do we get it from? It's not that easy to find. This is Richard Layard again. People in the West have got no happier in the last 50 years. They've become much richer. They work much less. They have longer holidays. They travel more. They live longer. They're healthier. But believe it or not, we're no happier. And that's shocking, really, isn't it? But it's also telling us something very important. You know, why can't we find this happiness that we're made to seek? One of the most quoted passages in C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity talks about this. Let me read it to you. Most people, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never quite keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. I'm not talking, he says, about unsuccessful marriages or holidays. I'm talking about the best possible ones. There is always something grasped at in that moment of longing without which fades away in the reality. The spouse may be a good spouse. The scenery on our trip is excellent. The job is just what we wanted, but it has evaded us. The thing we were longing for is always just out of reach. And Lewis argues that this deep, universal desire for something that can't be satisfied in this world is telling us that we're made for something beyond the world. We're made for something we won't find here, for our Creator. Now, if you're visiting today, I have to tell you, Christians have a very strange belief that it's very hard to know how we came up with it. And it is that God is a three-personed dance of love right at the center of ultimate reality, a fountain of goodness and beauty and truth springing up between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and that dance of love is what we're made to share in. And that means we're made to love, which is why love is so important to us and why we can't survive without it. It's why relationships are more important to us than money and why the door to happiness opens outward. But the real, pure, enduring love which will satisfy our soul is not to be found in this world. So don't give up your desire for happiness. Nurture it, listen to it. It's central to who you are, and it's telling you something very significant. But don't look to find the answer to it in the wrong place. Don't look, for instance, to marriage and finding the perfect partner, what the writer Ernest Becker called apocalyptic romance. You know, the idea, if I can just meet the right person, then all my problems will be over. I'll be happy forever. No, you won't. You know, you'll just be disappointed by that person and crush them with your unrealistic expectations, because they're just a flawed, fallible human being like you are. And so if we love anything in this world with the love that is meant for God, whether it's partners, pop stars, money, work, success, fame, or anything else, we'll get ourselves into trouble and we'll never be satisfied. Augustine was probably the first Christian to articulate this, and he famously said this: "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." And he used himself as an example. He had a very good friend who he cared for intensely, and the friend died suddenly. And he said later, "I loved a person who was sure to die as if he would never die. I loved a person who was sure to die as if he would never die." He said, "There's no true rest in the transient things of this world. They fly away." But Jesus said, "Come to me and I will give you rest." In Jesus, there is true rest for your soul. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't love God or our family. Of course we should. Don't detach yourself from them. But love God first. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, as Jesus said, is the first commandment. And if you get God first in your life, then you'll find everything else will fall into perspective. You won't look to the things of this world to find your deepest contentment, and then you can enjoy them for what they are. Money is just money. Career is just career. They're good things. They're God-given things. But they're not where you invest your whole self. Work is a great way to use your gifts and be useful, but don't expect to get your whole identity from it. And similarly, money is very useful for caring for your family and doing good, but it's not the source of your security and contentment. Our real hope is beyond the world. Jonathan Edwards was a famous preacher in North America in the 18th century, and his first sermon was entitled Christian Happiness. He was only 18 at the time, and the basic point was that Christians should be happy. And he said, for these three reasons: one, our bad things will turn out for good; two, our good things cannot be taken away from us; three, the best things are yet to come. See, if you really begin to take that on board, then you're beginning to live wisely, and you're beginning to get a contentment and a calmness and a security that things of this world will never give you. Okay, I'm nearly done. But how do we learn to love God with all our heart? We can't just say, "I'm going to love him." You can't force your heart to love something by telling it to. And if we think of God as some sort of vague, abstract deity of love out there somewhere, then it won't change us. We have to look at who God really is, and that means looking at Jesus Christ, who came into this world and gave his life for us. That's how we know that God is love. And what changes you is realizing that Jesus came into this world for you. You know, if you think you're a pretty good person, and you think you don't really need anyone to die for you, I'm basically pretty lovable, then, you know, your heart won't really be changed by thinking about Jesus. But if you think, "I pushed God out of my life, I took all the good things he gave me and I just used them for myself and I sought my own selfish things, and yet God loved me so much he came and gave everything for me, he gave his life for me on the cross," then your heart starts to be melted and changed, and you begin to feel to be filled with a new awe and wonder and joy at God's love for you. And then your treasure and your hope begins to be beyond this world, and you start to get all the good things of this world into perspective. So we're going to sing a hymn, an old hymn, that enables us really to focus on that God who loves us and to think about what it means for me. And it's "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." So when the music starts, do stand to sing.